When the Silasta Gamma fiends tried to use it to blow up a strangular stiletten munitions dump in one of the Gamma caves, they were extremely irritated that it didn't work, and said so. Haktar had been shocked by the whole idea. He tried to explain that he'd been thinking about this ultimate weapon business and had worked out that there was no conceivable consequence of not setting the bomb off that was worse than the known consequence of setting it off, and he had therefore taken the liberty of introducing a small flaw into the design of the bomb, and he hoped that everyone involved would, on sober reflection, feel that the Silastic armor fiends disagreed and pulverized the computer. Later, they thought better of it and destroyed the faulty bomb as well. Then, pausing only to smash the hell out of the strenuous Gar fighters of Stug and the strangular stilettons of Jajazikstak, they then went on to find an entirely new way of blowing themselves up, which was a profound relief to everyone else in the galaxy, particularly the Gar fighters, the stilettons, and the potatoes. Trillian had watched all this, as well as the story of Cricket. She emerged from the room of informational illusions thoughtfully, just in time to discover that they had arrived too late. Chapter 25. Even as the starship Bistromath flickered into objective being on the top of a small cliff on the mile-wide asteroid that pursued a lonely and eternal path in orbit around the enclosed star system of Cricket, its crew was aware that they were in time only to be witnesses to an unstoppable historic event. They didn't realize they were going to see two. They stood cold, lonely, and helpless on the cliff edge and watched the activity below. Lances of light wheeled in sinister arcs against the void from a point only about 100 yards below and in front of them. They stared into the blinding event. An extension of the ship's field enabled them to stand there by once again exploiting the mind's predisposition to have tricks played on it. The problems of falling up off the tiny mass of the asteroid or of not being able to breathe simply became somebody else's. The white Cricket warship was parked among the stark grey crags of the asteroid, alternately flaring under arc lights or disappearing in shadow. The black shadows cast by the hard rocks danced together in wild choreography as the arc lights swept around them. The 11 white robots were bearing in procession the wicket key out into the middle of a circle of swinging lights. The wicket key had been rebuilt. Its components shone and glittered. The steel pillar, or Marvin's leg, of strength and power. The golden bale, or heart of the infinite improbability drive, of prosperity. The perspex pillar, or Argabuthon scepter of justice, of science and reason. The silver bale, or Rory Award, for the most gratuitous use of the word fuck in a serious screenplay, and the now reconstituted wooden pillar, or ashes of a burnt stump signifying the death of English cricket, of nature and spirituality. "I suppose there is nothing we can do at this point?" asked Arthur nervously. "No," sighed Slarty Bartfast. The expression of disappointment that crossed Arthur's face was a complete failure, and since he was standing obscured by shadow, he allowed it to collapse into one of relief. Pity, he said. "We have no weapons," said Slotty Bartfast, stupidly. Damn, said Arthur very quietly. Ford said nothing. Trillian said nothing, but in a peculiarly thoughtful and distinct way. She was staring at that blankness of the space beyond the asteroid. The asteroid circled the dust cloud that surrounded the slow-time envelope that enclosed the world on which lived the people of Cricket, the masters of Cricket and their killer robots. The helpless group had no way of knowing whether or not the Cricket robots were aware of their presence. They could only assume that they must be, but they felt, quite rightly in the circumstances, that they had nothing to fear. They had an historic task to perform, and their audience could be regarded with contempt. "Terribly impotent feeling, isn't it?" said Arthur, but the others ignored him. In the centre of the area of light that the robots were approaching, a square-shaped crack appeared in the ground. The crack defined itself more and more distinctly, and soon it became clear that a block of the ground, about 6 feet square, was slowly rising. At the same time, they became aware of some other movement, but it was also subliminal, and for a moment or two it was not clear what it was that was moving. Then it became clear. The asteroid was moving. It was moving in toward the dust cloud, as if being hauled inexorably by some celestial angler in its depths. They were to make in real life the journey through the cloud that they had already made in the room of informational illusions. They stood frozen in silence. Trillian frowned. An age seemed to pass. Events seemed to pass with spinning slowness as the leading edge of the asteroid passed into the vague and soft outer perimeter of the cloud. And soon they were engulfed in a thin and dancing obscurity. They passed on through it, on and on, dimly aware of vague shapes and walls, indistinguishable in the darkness except in the corner of the eye. The dust dimmed the shafts of brilliant light. The shafts of brilliant light twinkled on the myriad specks of dust. Trillian again regarded the passage from within her own frowning thoughts. And they were through it. Whether it had taken a minute or half an hour, they weren't sure, but they were through it and confronted with a fresh blankness, as if space were pinched out of existence in front of them. And now things moved quickly. A blinding shaft of light seemed almost to explode from out of the block that had risen 3 feet out of the ground, and out of that rose a smaller perspex block, dazzling with interior dancing colours. The block was slotted with deep grooves, three upright and two across, clearly designed to accept the wicket key. The robots approached the lock, slotted the key into its home, and stepped back again. The block twisted around of its own accord, and space began to alter. As space unpinched itself, it seemed agonizingly to twist the eyes of the watchers in their sockets. They found themselves staring, blinded, at an unravelled sun that stood now before them, where it seemed only seconds before there had not been even empty space. It was a second or two before they were even sufficiently aware of what had happened to throw their hands up over their horrified, blinded eyes. In that second or two, they were aware of a tiny speck moving slowly across the eye of that sun. They staggered back and heard ringing in their ears the thin and unexpected chant of the robots crying out in unison, "Cricket! Cricket! Cricket! Cricket!" The sound chilled them. It was harsh, it was cold, it was empty, it was mechanically dismal. It was also triumphant. They were so stunned by these two sensory shocks that they almost missed the second historic event. Zaphod Beeblebrox, the only man in history to survive a direct blast attack from the cricket robots, ran out of the cricket warship, brandishing a zap gun. "Okay," he cried, "the situation is totally under control as of this moment in time." The single robot guarding the hatchway to the ship silently swung his battle club and connected it with the back of Zaphod's left head. "Who the zark did that?" said his left head, and lolled sickeningly forward. His right head gazed keenly into the middle distance. "Who did what?" it said. The club connected with the back of his right head. Zaphod measured his length and rather strange shape on the ground. Within a matter of seconds, the whole event was over. A few blasts from the robot were sufficient to destroy the lock forever. It split and melted, and splayed its contents brokenly, and the robots marched grimly and, it almost seemed, in a slightly disheartened manner, back into their warship, which, with a foop, was gone. Trillian and Ford ran hectically around and down the steep incline to the dark, still body of Zaphod Beeblebrox. Chapter 26. "I don't know," said Zaphod, for what seemed to him like the 37th time. "They could have killed me, but they didn't. Maybe they just thought I was a kind of wonderful guy or something. I could understand that." The others silently registered their opinions of this theory. Zaphod lay on the cold floor of the flight deck. His back seemed to wrestle the floor as pain thudded through him and banged at his heads. "I think," he whispered, "that there's something wrong with those anodized dudes, something fundamentally weird."
"They are programmed to kill everybody," Slotty Bartfast pointed out.
"That," wheezed Zaphod between the whacking thuds, "could be it." He didn't seem altogether convinced. "Hey, baby," he said to Trillian, hoping this would make up for his previous behaviour. "You all right?" she said gently.
Yeah, he said, I'm fine. Good, she said, and walked away to think. She stared at the huge visi screen over the flight couches, and twisting a switch, she flipped local images over it. One image was the blankness of the dust cloud, one was the sun of cricket, one was cricket itself. She flipped between them fiercely. Well, that's goodbye galaxy, then, said Arthur, slapping his knees and standing up. No, said Slarty Bartfast gravely, our course is clear. He furrowed his brow until you could grow some of the smaller root vegetables in it. He stood up, he paced around. When he spoke again, what he said frightened him so much he had to sit down again. We must go down to cricket, he said. A deep sigh shook his old frame, and his eyes seemed almost to rattle in their sockets. Once again, he said, we have failed pathetically, quite pathetically. That, said Ford quietly, is because we don't care enough, I told you. He swung his feet up onto the instrument panel and picked fitfully at something on one of his fingernails. But unless we determine to take action, said the old man querulously, as if struggling against something deeply insouciant in his nature, then we shall all be destroyed, we shall all die, surely we care about that. Yeah, not enough to want to get killed over it, said Ford. He put on a sort of hollow smile and flipped it around the room at anyone who wanted to see it. Slarty Bartfast clearly found this point of view extremely seductive, and he fought against it. He turned again to Zaphod, who was gritting his teeth and sweating with the pain. You surely must have some idea, he said, of why they spared your life. It seems most strange and unusual. I kind of think they didn't know, shrugged Zaphod. I told you, they hit me with the most feeble blast, just knocked me out, right? They lugged me into their ship, dumped me in a corner and ignored me, like they were embarrassed about me being there. If I said anything, they knocked me out again. We had some great conversations. Hey, hi there, I wonder, kept me amused for hours, you know. He winced again. He was toying with something in his fingers. He held it up. It was the golden bale. The heart of gold, the heart of the infinite improbability drive. Only that and the wooden pillar had survived the destruction of the lock intact. I hear your ship can move a bit, he said, so how'd you like to zip me back to mine before you... Will you not help us? Said Slarty Bartfast. Us, said Ford sharply. Who's us? I'd love to stay and help you save the galaxy, insisted Zaphod, raising himself up onto his shoulders. But I have the mother and father of a pair of headaches, and I feel a lot of little headaches coming on. But next time we need saving, I'm your guy. Hey, Trillion Baby! She looked around briefly. Yes? You want to come, Heart of Gold? Excitement and adventure and really wild things? I'm going down to cricket, she said. Chapter 27 It was the same hill, and yet not the same. This time it was not an informational illusion. This was cricket itself, and they were standing on it. Near them, behind the trees, stood the strange Italian restaurant that had brought these, their real bodies, to this, the real, present world of cricket. The strong grass under their feet was real, the rich soil real, too. The heady fragrances from the tree, too, were real. The night was real night. Cricket. Possibly the most dangerous place in the galaxy for anyone who isn't a cricketer to stand. The place that could not countenance the existence of any other place, whose charming, delightful, intelligent inhabitants would howl with fear, savagery, and murderous hate when confronted with anyone not their own. Arthur shuddered. Slarty Bartfast shuddered. Ford, surprisingly, shuddered. It was not surprising that he shuddered, it was surprising that he was there at all. But when they had returned Zaphod to his ship, Ford had felt unexpectedly shamed into not running away. Wrong, he thought to himself, wrong, wrong, wrong. He hugged to himself one of the zap guns with which they had armed themselves out of Zaphod's armory. Trillian shuddered and frowned as she looked into the sky. This, too, was not the same. It was no longer blank and empty. While the countryside around them had changed little in the 2,000 years of the cricket wars, and the mere 5 years that had elapsed locally since cricket was sealed in its slow time envelope 10 billion years ago, the sky was dramatically different. Dim lights and heavy shapes hung in it. High in the sky, where no cricketer ever looked, were the war zones, the robot zones, huge warships and tower blocks floating in the Nilograv fields far above the idyllic pastoral lands of the surface of Cricket. Trillian stared at them and thought. Trillian, whispered Ford Prefect to her. Yes, she said. What are you doing? Thinking. Do you always breathe like that when you're thinking? I wasn't aware that I was breathing. That's what worried me. I think I know, said Trillian. Shh, said Slarty Bartfast in alarm, and his thin, trembling hand motioned them farther back beneath the shadow of the tree. Suddenly, as before in the tape, there were lights coming along the hill path. But this time the dancing beams were not from lanterns, but flashlights. Not in itself a dramatic change, but every detail made their hearts thump with fear. This time there were no lilting, whimsical songs about flowers and farming and dead dogs, but hushed voices in urgent debate. A light moved in the sky with slow weight. Arthur was clenched with a claustrophobic terror, and the warm wind caught at his throat. Within seconds, a second party became visible, approaching from the other side of the dark hill. They were moving swiftly and purposefully, their flashlights swinging and probing around them. The parties were clearly converging, and not merely with each other. They were converging deliberately on the spot where Arthur and the others were standing. Arthur heard the slight rustle as Ford Prefect raised his zap gun to his shoulder, and the slight whimpering cough as Slarty Bartfast raised his. He felt the cold, unfamiliar weight of his own gun, and with shaking hands, he raised it. His fingers fumbled to release the safety catch and engage the extreme danger catch, as Ford had shown him. He was shaking so much that if he'd fired at anybody at that moment, he probably would have burnt his signature on them. Only Trillian didn't raise her gun. She raised her eyebrows, lowered them again, and bit her lip in thought. "Has it occurred to you," she began, but nobody wanted to discuss anything much at the moment. A light stabbed through the darkness from behind them, and they spun round to find a third party of cricketers behind them, searching them out with their flashlights. Ford Prefect's gun crackled viciously, but fire spat back at it and it crashed from his hands. There was a moment of pure fear, a frozen second before anyone fired again, and at the end of the second, nobody fired. They were surrounded by pale-faced cricketers and bathed in bobbing torchlight. The captives stared at their captors. The captors stared at their captives. "Hello," said one of the captors. "Excuse me, but are you aliens?" Chapter 28. Meanwhile, more millions of miles away than the mind can comfortably encompass, Zaphod Beeblebrox was feeling bored. He'd repaired his ship, that is, he'd watched with alert interest while a service robot had repaired it for him. It was now, once again, one of the most powerful and extraordinary ships in existence. He could go anywhere, do anything. He fiddled with the book, and then tossed it away. It was the one he'd read before. He walked over to the communications bank and opened an all-frequencies emergency channel. "Anyone want a drink?" he asked. "This an emergency, fella?" crackled a voice from halfway across the galaxy. "Got any mixers?" said Zaphod. "No, go take a ride on a comet." "Okay, okay," said Zaphod, and flipped the channel shut again. He sighed and sat down. He got up again and wandered over to a computer screen. He pushed a few buttons. Little blobs started to rush around the screen, eating each other. "Pow!" said Zaphod. "For you! Pop, pop, pop!" "Hi there," said the computer briefly after a minute of this. "You have scored 3 points. Previous best score, 7,797,200." "Okay, okay," said Zaphod, and flipped the screen blank again. He sat down again. He played with the pencil. This, too, began slowly to lose its fascination. "Okay, okay," he said, and fed his score and the previous best one into the computer. His ship made a blur of the universe. Chapter 29. "Tell us," said the thin, pale-faced cricketer who had stepped forward from the ranks of the others and stood uncertainly in the circle of light, handling his gun as if he was just holding it for someone else who'd just popped off somewhere but will be back in a minute.
do you know anything about something called the balance of nature? There was no reply from their captives, or at least nothing more articulate than a few confused mumbles and grunts. The flashlight continued to play over them. High in the sky above them, dark activity continued in the robot zones. It's just, continued the cricketer uneasily, something we heard about. Probably nothing important. Well, I suppose we'd better kill you, then. He looked down at his gun as if he were trying to find which bit to press. That is, he said, looking up again, unless there's anything you want to chat about? Slow, numb astonishment crept up the bodies of Slarty Bartfast, Ford, and Arthur. Very soon it would reach their brains, which were at the moment solely occupied with moving their jawbones up and down. Trillian was shaking her head, as if trying to finish a jigsaw puzzle by shaking the box. "We're worried, you see," said another man from the crowd, "about this plan of universal destruction." "Yes," added another, "and the balance of nature. It just seemed to us that if the whole of the rest of the universe is destroyed, it'll somehow upset the balance. We're quite keen on ecology, you see." His voice trailed away unhappily. "And sport," said another loudly. This got a cheer of approval from the others. Yes, agreed the first. And sport. He looked back at his fellows uneasily and scratched fitfully at his cheek. He seemed to be wrestling with some deep inner confusion, as if everything he wanted to say and everything he thought were entirely different things between which he could see no possible connection. You see, he mumbled, some of us... And he looked around again as if for confirmation. The others made encouraging noises. Some of us, he continued, are quite keen to have sporting links with the rest of the galaxy, and though I can see the argument about keeping sport out of politics, I think that if we want to have sporting links with the rest of the galaxy, which we do, then it's probably a mistake to destroy it, and indeed the rest of the universe. His voice trailed away again. Which is what seems to be the idea now.
What? Said Slarty Bartfast. What?
Huh? Said Arthur.
Dri, said Ford Prefect.
Okay, said Trillian. Let's talk about it. She walked forward and took the poor, confused cricketer by the arm. He looked about 25, which meant, because of the peculiar manglings of time that had been going on in this area, that he would have been just 20 when the cricket wars were finished 10 billion years ago. Trillian led him for a short walk through the light before she said anything more. He stumbled uncertainly after her. The encircling flashlight beams were drooping slightly now, as if they were abdicating to the strange, quiet girl who alone in this universe of dark confusion seemed to know what she was doing. She turned and faced him and lightly held both his arms. He was a picture of bewildered misery. "Tell me," she said. He said nothing for a moment, while his gaze darted from one of her eyes to the other. "We," he said, "we have to be alone, I think." He screwed up his face and then dropped his head forward, shaking it like someone trying to shake a coin out of a money box. He looked up again. "We have this bomb now, you see," he said. "It's just a little one."
"I know," she said.
He goggled at her as if she'd said something very strange about beetroots.
"Honestly," he said, "it's very, very little."
"I know," she said again.
"But they say," his voice trailed on, "they say it can destroy everything that exists. And we have to do that, you see, I think. Will that make us alone? I don't know. It seems to be our function, though," he said, and dropped his head again.
"Whatever that means," said a hollow voice from the crowd. Trillian slowly put her arms around the poor, bewildered young cricketer and patted his trembling head on her shoulder. "It's all right," she said, quietly, but clearly enough for all the shadowy crowd to hear. "You don't have to do it." She rocked him. "You don't have to do it," she said again. She let him go and stood back.
"I want you to do something for me," she said, and unexpectedly laughed. "I want," she said, and laughed again. She put her hand over her mouth and then said with a straight face, "I want you to take me to your leader." And she pointed into the war zones in the sky. She seemed somehow to know that their leader would be there. Her laughter seemed to discharge something in the atmosphere. From somewhere at the back of the crowd, a single voice started to sing a tune that would have enabled Paul McCartney, had he written it, to buy the world. Chapter 30. Seyfried Beeblebrox crawled bravely along a tunnel like the hell of a guy he was. He was very confused, but continued crawling doggedly anyway because he was that brave. He was confused by something he had just seen, but not half as confused as he was going to be by something he was about to hear, so it would be best at this point to explain exactly where he was. He was in the robot war zones, many miles above the surface of the planet Cricket. The atmosphere was thin here, and relatively unprotected from any rays or anything that space might care to hurl in this direction. He had parked the starship Heart of Gold among the huge, jostling, dim hulks that crowded the sky here above Cricket, and had entered what appeared to be the biggest and most important of the sky buildings, armed with nothing but a zap gun and something for his headaches. He had found himself in a long, wide and badly lit corridor, in which he was able to hide until he worked out what he was going to do next. He hid because every now and then one of the Cricket robots would walk along it, and although he had so far led some kind of charmed life at their hands, it had nevertheless been an extremely painful one, and he had no desire to stretch what he was only half inclined to call his good fortune. He had ducked at one point into a room leading off the corridor, and had discovered it to be a huge and again dimly lit chamber. In fact, it was a museum with just one exhibit, the wreckage of a spacecraft. It was terribly burnt and mangled, and now that he'd caught up with some of the galactic history he'd missed through his failed attempts to have sex with the girl in the cyber cubicle next to him at school, he was able to put in an intelligent guess that this was the wrecked spaceship that had drifted through the dust cloud all those billions of years ago and started this whole business off. But, and this is where he had become confused, there was something not at all right about it. It was genuinely wrecked. It was genuinely burnt, but a fairly brief inspection by an experienced eye revealed that it was not a genuine spacecraft. It was as if it were a full-scale model of one, a solid blueprint. In other words, it was a very useful thing to have around if you suddenly decided to build a spaceship yourself and didn't know how to do it. It was not, however, anything that would ever fly anywhere itself. He was still puzzling over this, in fact he'd only just started to puzzle over it, when he became aware that a door had slid open in another part of the chamber, and another couple of Cricket robots had entered, looking a little glum. Seyfried did not want to tangle with them, and deciding that just as discretion was the better part of valour, so was cowardice the better part of discretion, he valiantly hid himself in a cupboard. The cupboard, in fact, turned out to be the top part of a shaft that led down through an inspection hatch into a wide ventilation tunnel. He let himself down into it and started to crawl along it. He didn't like it. It was cold, dark, and profoundly uncomfortable, and it frightened him. At the first opportunity, which was another shaft 100 yards further along, he climbed back up out of it. This time he emerged into a smaller chamber, which appeared to be a computer intelligence center. He emerged in a dark, narrow space between a large computer bank and the wall. He quickly learned that he was not alone in the chamber, and started to leave again when he began to listen with interest to what the other occupants were saying. "It's the robots, sir," said one voice. "There's something wrong with them." "What exactly?" These were the voices of two War Command cricketers. All the war commanders lived up in the sky in the robot war zones and were largely immune to the whimsical doubts and uncertainties that were afflicting their fellows down on the surface of the planet. "Well, sir, I think it's just as well that they're being phased out of the war effort and that we are now going to detonate the supernova bomb. In the very short time since we were released from the envelope, get to the point. The robots aren't enjoying it, sir." "What?" "The war, sir. It seems to be getting them down. There's a certain world weariness about them, or perhaps I should say universe weariness." "Well, that's all right. They're meant to be helping to destroy it." "Oh, yes, well, they're finding it difficult, sir. They're afflicted with a certain lassitude. They're just finding it hard to get behind the job. They lack oomph."
"What are you trying to say?"
"Well, I think they're very depressed about something, sir."
"What on cricket are you talking about?"
"Well, in the few skirmishes they've had recently, it seems that they go into battle, raise their weapons to fire, and suddenly think, why bother? What, cosmically speaking, is it all about? And they just seem to get a little tired and a little grim."
And then what do they do? Quadratic equations, mostly, sir. Fiendishly difficult ones, by all accounts. And then they sulk.
Sulk?
Yes, sir. Who ever heard of a robot sulking?
I don't know, sir.
What was that noise?
It was the noise of Zaphod leaving, with his heads spinning.
Chapter 31. In a deep well of darkness, a crippled robot sat. It had been silent in its metallic darkness for some time. It was cold and damp, but being a robot, it was supposed not to be able to notice these things. With an enormous effort of will, however, it did manage to notice them. Its brain had been harnessed to the central intelligence core of the Cricket war computer. It wasn't enjoying the experience, and neither was the central intelligence of the Cricket war computer. The Cricket robots, who had salvaged this pathetic metal creature from the swamps of Squanchula Zeta, had done so because they had recognized almost immediately its gigantic intelligence and the use this could be to them. They hadn't reckoned with the attendant personality disorders, which the coldness, the darkness, the dampness, the crampedness, and the loneliness were doing nothing to decrease. It was not happy with its task. Apart from anything else, the mere coordination of an entire planet's military strategy was only taking up a tiny part of its formidable mind, and the rest of it had become extremely bored. Having solved all the major mathematical, physical, chemical, biological, sociological, philosophical, etymological, meteorological, and psychological problems of the universe, except his own, three times over, he was severely stuck for something to do, and had taken up composing short, dolorous ditties of no tone, or indeed tune. The latest one was a lullaby. Marvin droned, "Now the world has gone to bed, darkness won't engulf my head. I can see by infrared. How I hate the night." He paused to gather the artistic and emotional strength to tackle the next verse. "Now I lay me down to sleep, try to count electric sheep. Sweet dream wishes you can keep. How I hate the night."
"Marvin," hissed a voice. His head snapped up, almost dislodging the intricate network of electrodes that connected him to the central Cricket war computer. An inspection hatch had opened, and one of a pair of unruly heads was peering through while the other kept on jogging it by continually darting to look this way and that, extremely nervously.
"Oh, it's you," muttered the robot. "I might have known."
"Hey, kid," said Zaphod in astonishment. "Was that you singing just then?"
"I am," Marvin acknowledged bitterly, "in particularly scintillating form at the moment."
Zaphod poked his head into the hatchway and looked around. "Are you alone?" he said.
"Yes," said Marvin. "Wearily I sit here, pain and misery my only companions, and vast intelligence, of course, and infinite sorrow, and..."
"Yeah," said Zaphod. "Yeah, what's your connection with all this?"
"This," said Marvin, indicating with his less damaged arm all the electrodes that connected him with the Cricket computer.
"Then," said Zaphod awkwardly, "I guess you must have saved my life. Twice."
"Three times," said Marvin.
Zaphod's head snapped round. His other one was looking hawkishly in entirely the wrong direction, just in time to see the lethal killer robot directly behind him seize up and start to smoke. It staggered backward and slumped against a wall. It slid down. It slipped sideways, threw its head back, and started to sob inconsolably.
Zaphod looked back at Marvin.
"You must have a terrific outlook on life," he said.
"Just don't even ask," said Marvin.
"I won't," said Zaphod, and didn't. "Hey, look," he added, "you're doing a terrific job."
"Which means, I suppose," said Marvin, and requiring only 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,
kiss me or anything like that.
Kid, you know I'd love to.
But you're not going to.
No.
I see.
You're working well.
Yes, said Marvin. Why stop now, just when I'm hating it?
I have to go find Trillian and the guys. Hey, you any idea where they are? I mean, I just got a planet to choose from. Could take a while.
They are very close, said Marvin dolefully. You can monitor them from here if you like.
I'd better go get them, asserted Zaphod. Maybe they need some help, right?
Maybe, said Marvin, with unexpected authority in his lugubrious voice, it would be better if you monitored them from here. That young girl, he added unexpectedly, is one of the least benightedly unintelligent organic life forms it has been my profound lack of pleasure not to be able to avoid meeting.
Zaphod took a moment or two to find his way through this labyrinthine string of negatives, and emerged at the other end with surprise.
Trillian, he said. Ah, she's just a kid. Cute, yeah, but temperamental. You know how it is with women. Oh, perhaps you don't. I assume you don't. If you don't, I don't want to hear about it. Plug us in.
Totally manipulated.
What?
Said Zaphod. It was Trillian speaking. He turned round. The wall against which the cricket robot was sobbing had lit up to reveal a scene taking place in some other unknown part of the cricket robot war zones. It seemed to be a council chamber of some kind. Zaphod couldn't make it out too clearly because of the robot slumped against the screen. He tried to move the robot, but it was heavy with its grief and tried to bite him, so he just looked around it as best he could.
Just think about it, said Trillian's voice. Your history is just a series of freakishly improbable events, and I know an improbable event when I see one. Your complete isolation from the galaxy was freakish for a start. Right out on the very edge with a dust cloud around you? It's a setup, obviously.
Zaphod was mad with frustration that he couldn't see the screen. The robot's head was obscuring his view of the people Trillian was talking to. Its multifunctional battle club was obscuring the background, and the elbow of the arm it had pressed tragically against its brow was obscuring Trillian herself.
Then, said Trillian, the spaceship that crash-landed on your planet. That's really likely, isn't it? Have you any idea what the odds are against a drifting spaceship accidentally intersecting with the orbit of a planet?
Hey, said Zaphod. She doesn't know what the Zark she's talking about. I've seen that spaceship. It's a fake. No deal.
I thought it might be, said Marvin from his prison behind Zaphod.
Oh, yeah, said Zaphod. It's easy for you to say that. I just told you. Anyway, I don't see what it's got to do with anything.
And especially, continued Trillian, the odds against it intersecting with the orbit of the one planet in the galaxy, or the whole of the universe, as far as I know, that will be totally traumatized to see it. You don't know what the odds are, nor do I. They're that big. Again, it's a setup. I wouldn't be surprised if that spaceship was just a fake.
Zaphod managed to move the robot's battle club. Behind it on the screen were the figures of Ford, Arthur, and Slarty Bartfast, who appeared astonished and bewildered by the whole thing.
Hey, look, said Zaphod excitedly. The guys are doing great. Rah, rah, rah. Go get 'em, guys.
And what about, said Trillian, all this technology you suddenly managed to build for yourselves almost overnight? Most people would take thousands of years to do all that. Someone was feeding you what you needed to know. Someone was keeping you at it.
I know, she added in response to some unseen interruption. I know you didn't realize it was going on. That is exactly my point. You never realized anything at all. Like the supernova bomb.
How do you know about that? Said an unseen voice.
I just know, said Trillian. You expect me to believe that you are bright enough to invent something that brilliant and will be too dumb to realize it would take you with it as well? That's not just stupid, that's spectacularly obtuse.
Hey, what's this bomb thing? Said Zaphod in alarm to Marvin.
The supernova bomb, said Marvin. It's a very, very small bomb.
Yeah?
That would destroy the universe completely, added Marvin. Good idea, if you ask me. They won't get it to work, though.
Why not, if it's so brilliant?
It's brilliant, said Marvin. They're not. They got as far as designing it before they were locked in the envelope. They've spent the last 5 years building it. They think they've got it right, but they haven't. They're as stupid as any other organic life form. I hate them.
Trillian was continuing.
Zaphod tried to pull the cricket robot away by its leg, but it kicked and growled at him and then quaked with a fresh outburst of sobbing. Then suddenly it slumped over and continued to express its feelings out of everybody's way on the floor. Trillian was standing alone in the middle of the chamber, tired but with fiercely burning eyes. Ranged in front of her were the pale-faced and wrinkled elder masters of cricket. Motionless behind their widely curved control desk, staring at her with helpless fear and hatred. In front of them, equidistant between their control desk and the middle of the chamber where Trillian stood, as if on trial, was a slim white pillar about 4 feet tall. On top of it stood a small white globe, about 3, maybe 4 inches in diameter. Beside it stood a cricket robot with its multifunctional battle club. "In fact," explained Trillian, "you are so dumb stupid." She was sweating. Zaphod felt this was an unattractive thing for her to be doing at this point. "You're all so dumb stupid that I very much doubt if you've been able to build the bomb properly without any help from Haktar for the last 5 years. "Who's this guy Haktar?" said Zaphod, squaring his shoulders. If Marvin replied, Zaphod didn't hear him. All his attention was concentrated on the screen. One of the elders of cricket made a small motion with his hand toward the cricket robot. The robot raised its club. "There's nothing I can do," said Marvin. "It's on an independent circuit from the others." "Wait," said Trillian. The elder made a small motion. The robot halted. Trillian suddenly seemed very doubtful of her own judgment. "How do you know all this?" said Zaphod to Marvin at this point. "Computer records," said Marvin. "I have access." "You're very different, aren't you?" said Trillian to the Elder Masters. "From your fellow worldlings down on the ground. You've spent all your lives up here, unprotected by the atmosphere. You've been vulnerable. The rest of your race is very frightened, you know. They don't want you to do this. You're out of touch. Why don't you check up?" The cricket elder grew impatient. He made a gesture to the robot that was precisely the opposite of the gesture he had last made to it. The robot swung its battle club. It hit the small white globe. The small white globe was the supernova bomb. It was a very, very small bomb that was designed to bring the entire universe to an end. The supernova bomb flew through the air. It hit the back wall of the council chamber and dented it very badly.
"So how does she know all this?" said Zaphod.
Marvin kept a sullen silence.
"Ah, probably just bluffing," said Zaphod. "Poor kid, I should never have left her alone."
Chapter 32. "Haktar," called Trillian. "What are you up to?" There was no reply from the enclosing darkness. Trillian waited nervously. She was sure that she couldn't be wrong. She peered into the gloom from which she had been expecting some kind of response, but there was only cold silence. "Haktar," she called again, "I would like you to meet my friend Arthur Dent. I wanted to go off with a thunder god, but he wouldn't let me, and I appreciate that. He made me realize where my affections really lay. Unfortunately, Zaphod is too frightened by all this, so I brought Arthur instead. I'm not sure why I'm telling you all this." "Hello?" she said again. "Haktar!" And then it came. It was thin and feeble, like a voice carried on the wind from a great distance, half heard, a memory or a dream of a voice. "Won't you both come out?" said this voice. "I promise that you will be perfectly safe."